Chapter 3 Revenge of the Nerds. Somewhere beyond the edge of our solar system, hurtling into interstellar space, is a phonograph and a golden record with hieroglyphic instructions on the sleeve. They are attached to the Voyager 2 space probe, launched in 1977 to transmit photographs and data back to us from the outer planets in our solar system. Now that it is flown by Neptune and its thrilling scientific mission is over, it serves as an interplanetary calling card from us to any spacefaring extraterrestrial that might snag it. The astronomer Carl Sagan was the record producer, and he chose sights and sounds that captured our species and its accomplishments. He included greetings in 55 human languages and one whale language, a 12-minute sound essay made up of baby's cry, a kiss, and an EEG record of the meditations of a woman in love, and 90 minutes of music sampled from the world's idioms, Mexican mariachi, Peruvian panpipes, Indian raga, a Navajo night chant, a pygmy girl's initiation song, a Japanese shakuhachi piece, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, Stravinsky, Louis Armstrong, and Chuck Berry singing Johnny Be Good. The disc also bore a message of peace from our species to the cosmos. In an unintended bit of black comedy, the message was recited by the Secretary General of the United Nations at the time, Kurt Waldheim. Years later, historians discovered that Waldheim had spent World War II as an intelligence officer in a German army unit that carried out brutal reprisals against Balkan partisans and deported the Jewish population of Salonika to Nazi death camps. It's too late to call Voyager back, and this mordant joke on us will circle the center of the Milky Way galaxy forever. Get smart. The Voyager phonograph record, in any case, was a fine idea, if only because of the questions it raised. Are we alone? If not, do alien life forms have the intelligence and the desire to develop space travel? If so, would they interpret the sounds and images as we intended? Or would they hear the voice as the whine of a modem and see the line drawings of people on the cover as showing a race of wireframes? If they understood it, how would they respond? By ignoring us? By coming over to enslave us or eat us? Or by starting an interplanetary dialogue? In a Saturday Night Live skit, the long-awaited reply from outer space was, "Send more Chuck Berry." These are not just questions for late-night dorm room bull sessions. In the early 1990s, NASA allocated $100 million to a 10-year search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. Scientists were to listen with radio antennas for signals that could have come only from intelligent extraterrestrials. Predictably, some congressmen objected. One said it was a waste of federal money to look for little green men with misshapen heads. To minimize the giggle factor, NASA renamed the project the High Resolution Microwave Survey, but it was too late to save the project from the congressional axe. Currently, it is funded by donations from private sources, including Steven Spielberg. The opposition to SETI came not just from the know-nothings, but from some of the world's most distinguished biologists. Why did they join the discussion? SETI depends on assumptions from evolutionary theory, not just astronomy, in particular about the evolution of intelligence. Is intelligence inevitable, or was it a fluke? At a famous conference in 1961, the astronomer and SETI enthusiast Frank Drake noted that the number of extraterrestrial civilizations that might contact us can be estimated with the following formula. 1. The number of stars in the galaxy, times 2, the fraction of stars with planets, times 3, the number of planets per solar system with a life-supporting environment, times 4, the fraction of these planets on which life actually appears, times 5, the fraction of life-bearing planets on which intelligence emerges, times 6, the fraction of intelligent societies willing and able to communicate with other worlds, times 7, the longevity of each technology in the communicative state. The astronomers, physicists, and engineers at the conference felt unable to estimate factor 6 without a sociologist or a historian. but they felt confident in estimating factor 5, the proportion of life-bearing planets on which intelligence emerges. They decided it was 100%. Finding intelligent life elsewhere in the cosmos would be the most exciting discovery in human history. So why are the biologists being such grinches? It's because they sense that the SETI enthusiasts are reasoning from a pre-scientific folk belief. Centuries-old religious dogma, the Victorian ideal of progress, and modern secular humanism all lead people to misunderstand evolution as an internal yearning or unfolding toward greater complexity, climaxing in the appearance of man. The pressure builds up, and intelligence emerges like popcorn in a pan. The religious doctrine was called the Great Chain of Being, amoeba to monkey to man. And even today, many scientists thoughtlessly use words like higher and lower life forms, and the evolutionary scale and ladder. The parade of primates, from gangly-armed gibbon through stoop-shouldered caveman to upright modern man, has become an icon of pop culture, and we all understand what someone means when she says she turned down a date because the guy is not very evolved. In science fiction like H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, episodes of Star Trek, and stories from Boy's Life, the momentum is extrapolated to our descendants, shown as bald, varicose-veined, bulbous-brained, spindly-bodied homunculi. In The Planet of the Apes and other stories, after we have blown ourselves to smithereens or choked in our pollutants, apes or dolphins rise to the occasion and take on our mantle. Drake expressed these assumptions in a letter to Science, defending SETI against the eminent biologist Ernst Mayr. Mayr had noted that only one of the 50 million species on Earth had developed civilizations, so the probability that life on a given planet would include an intelligent species might well be very small. Drake replied, "The first species to develop intelligent civilizations will discover that it is the only such species. Should it be surprised? Someone must be first, and being first says nothing about how many other species had or have the potential to evolve into intelligent civilizations, or may do so in the future. Similarly, among many civilizations, one will be the first, and temporarily the only one, to develop electronic technology. How else could it be? The evidence does suggest that planetary systems need to exist in sufficiently benign circumstances for a few billion years for a technology-using species to evolve." To see why this thinking runs so afoul of the modern theory of evolution, consider an analogy. The human brain is an exquisitely complex organ that evolved only once. The elephant's trunk, which can stack logs, uproot trees, pick up a dime, remove thorns, powder the elephant with dust, siphon water, serve as a snorkel, and scribble with a pencil, is another complex organ that evolved only once. The brain and the trunk are products of the same evolutionary force, natural selection. Imagine an astronomer on the planet of the elephants defending SETI, the search for extraterrestrial trunks. The first species to develop a trunk will discover that it is the only such species. Should it be surprised? Someone must be first, and being first says nothing about how many other species had or have the potential to evolve trunks, or may do so in the future. Similarly, among many trunk-bearing species, one will be the first and temporarily the only one to powder itself with dust. The evidence does suggest that planetary systems need to exist in sufficiently benign circumstances for a few billion years for a trunk-using species to evolve. This reasoning strikes us as cockeyed because the elephant is assuming that evolution did not just produce the trunk in a species on this planet, but was striving to produce it in some lucky species, each waiting and hoping. The elephant is merely the first and temporarily the only one. Other species have the potential, though a few billion years will have to pass for the potential to be realized. Of course, we are not chauvinistic about trunks, so we can see that trunks evolved, but not because a rising tide made it inevitable. Thanks to fortuitous preconditions in the elephant's ancestors, large size and certain kinds of nostrils and lips, certain selective forces, the problems posed by lifting and lowering a huge head, and luck, the trunk evolved as a workable solution for those organisms at that time. Other animals did not and will not evolve trunks because in their bodies and circumstances it is of no great help. Could it happen again, here or elsewhere? It could, but the proportion of planets on which the necessary hand has been dealt in a given period of time is presumably small. Certainly, it is less than 100%. We are chauvinistic about our brains, thinking them to be the goal of evolution. And that makes no sense for reasons articulated over the years by Stephen Jay Gould. First, natural selection does nothing even close to striving for intelligence. The process is driven by differences in the survival and reproduction rates of replicating organisms in a particular environment. Over time, the organisms acquire designs that adapt them for survival and reproduction in that environment, period. Nothing pulls them in any direction other than success there and then. When an organism moves to a new environment, its lineage adapts accordingly. But the organisms who stayed behind in the original environment can prosper unchanged. Life is a densely branching bush, not a scale or a ladder, and living organisms are at the tips of the branches, not on lower rungs. Every organism alive today has had the same amount of time to evolve since the origin of life. The amoeba, the platypus, the rhesus macaque, and yes, Larry on the answering machine asking for another date. But, a SETI fan might ask, isn't it true that animals become more complex over time? And wouldn't intelligence be the culmination? In many lineages, of course, animals have become more complex. Life began simple, so the complexity of the most complex creature alive on Earth at any time has to increase over the eons. But in many lineages, they have not. The organisms reach an optimum and stay put, often for hundreds of millions of years. And those that do become more complex don't always become smarter. They become bigger, or faster, or more poisonous, or more fecund, or more sensitive to smells and sounds, or able to fly higher and farther, or better at building nests or dams, whatever works for them. Evolution is about ends, not means. Becoming smart is just one option. Still, isn't it inevitable that many organisms would take the route to intelligence? Often, different lineages converge on a solution, like the 40 different groups of animals that evolved complex designs for eyes. Presumably, you can't be too rich, too thin, or too smart. Why wouldn't human-like intelligence be a solution that many organisms, on this planet and elsewhere, might converge on? Evolution could indeed have converged on human-like intelligence several times, and perhaps that point could be developed to justify SETI. But in calculating the odds, it is not enough to think about how great it is to be smart. In evolutionary theory, that kind of reasoning merits the accusation that conservatives are always hurling at liberals. They specify a benefit, but neglect to factor in the costs. Organisms don't evolve toward every imaginable advantage. If they did, every creature would be faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, and able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. An organism that devotes some of its matter and energy to one organ must take it away from another. It must have thinner bones or less muscle or fewer eggs. Organs evolve only when their benefits outweigh their costs. Do you have a personal digital assistant like the Apple Newton? These are the handheld devices that recognize handwriting, store phone numbers, edit text, send faxes, keep schedules, and many other feats. They are marvels of engineering and can organize a busy life. But I don't have one, though I am a gadget lover. Whenever I'm tempted to buy a PDA, four things dissuade me. First, they are bulky. Second, they need batteries. Third, they take time to learn to use. Fourth, their sophistication makes simple tasks like looking up a phone number slow and cumbersome. I get by with a notebook and a fountain pen. The same disadvantages would face any creature pondering whether to evolve a human-like brain. First, the brain is bulky. The female pelvis barely accommodates a baby's outsized head. That design compromise kills many women during childbirth and requires a pivoting gait that makes women biomechanically less efficient walkers than men. Also, a heavy head bobbing around on a neck makes us more vulnerable to fatal injuries and accidents, such as falls. Second, the brain needs energy. Neural tissue is metabolically greedy. Our brains take up only 2% of our body weight, but consume 20% of our energy and nutrients. Third, brains take time to learn to use. We spend much of our lives either being children or caring for children. Fourth, simple tasks can be slow. My first graduate advisor was a mathematical psychologist who wanted to model the transmission of information in the brain by measuring reaction times to loud tones. Theoretically, the neuron-to-neuron transmission times should have added up to a few milliseconds. But there were 75 milliseconds unaccounted for between stimulus and response. There's all this cogitation going on, and we just want him to push his finger down, my advisor grumbled. Lower-tech animals can be much quicker. Some insects can bite in less than a millisecond. Perhaps this answers the rhetorical question in the sporting equipment ad. The average man's IQ is 107. The average brown trout's IQ is 4. So, why can't a man catch a brown trout? Intelligence isn't for everyone, any more than a trunk is, and this should give SETI enthusiasts pause. But I'm not arguing against the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. My topic is terrestrial intelligence, the fallacy that intelligence is some exalted ambition of evolution is part of the same fallacy that treats it as a divine essence or wonder tissue or all-encompassing mathematical principle. The mind is an organ, a biological gadget. We have our minds because their design attains outcomes whose benefits outweighed the costs in the lives of Pliopleistocene African primates. To understand ourselves, we need to know the how, why, where, and when of this episode in history. They are the subject of this chapter.